This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it's been nearly 35 years since the AIDS epidemic emerged, and finally we can say with some certainty that a tide has been turned in battling this global health challenge.
Well, there is some really encouraging reports coming out of this year's annual Global HIV/AIDS Conference in Vancouver. Researchers point to the news that early intervention with the antiretroviral treatment can delay HIV symptoms indefinitely, and new evidence that long-term exposure to the treatment isn't as harmful to vital organs' health.
And they really are looking at this as a treatable chronic condition in many cases. But of course, it must be managed. And as we know, it's sometimes difficult to get patients to comply with drug protocol.
Indeed, Mark, there are an estimated 50,000 newly diagnosed people infected with HIV in this country alone. Embedding HIV testing in routine preventive care is a evidence-based, very effective way to help patients know their status early and take those appropriate steps to avail themselves of treatment.
And UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon announced that they were on track to get Africa's 15 million HIV-positive patients on the antiretroviral treatment. That will go a long way towards curbing this pandemic.
Some scientists at the conference were predicting that HIV/AIDS, as we know it, could be over by 2030.
Wow.
That would be remarkable, but still much more work to do.
Our guest today is a physician with plenty of work to do. Dr. Stephen J. Stack is president of the American Medical Association, the chief lobbying organization representing physicians and medical students.
Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org, will be stopping by. She's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, you can email us at chcradio@chc1.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love hearing from you.
Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Stephen J. Stack in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Medicare has hit a milestone, 50 years in business, providing access to health coverage for the nation's seniors, 65 and over. A quick snapshot of the popular program shows, on average, seniors are healthier, living longer, and spending less time in the hospital than their earlier counterparts. And according to a recent study conducted by Yale physician Dr. Harlan Krumholz, there has been a vast improvement in care interventions over these past 15 years, interventions he calls remarkable and even jaw-dropping. The researchers looked at the experience of 60 million older Americans covered by Medicare between 1999 and 2013 and found mortality rates dropped steadily during that time, and people were much less likely to end up in the hospital. Krumholz says if rates had stayed the same in 2013 as they had been in 1999, we would have seen 3.5 million more hospitalizations. The study does note the biggest threat to Medicare solvency is the dramatic increase in the cost of pharmaceutical drugs. And on that note, we now have a cure for hepatitis C. Roughly 3 million Americans are living with hep C. Many can't afford the treatment because it's simply too expensive. A recent analysis has shown a spike in hep C infections due to lack of access to the expensive cure, about $80,000 per person. And Americans overall are feeling better. In a survey published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, 500,000 Americans polled said they were feeling better in the age of Obamacare than prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act. And having trouble achieving fitness success at the gym, why not try tapping into your natural hunter-gatherer instincts? A fitness movement sweeping through Europe is washing up on these shores with a direct link to our Homo sapien ancestry. The Move Nat movement suggests you skip the gym and go right to the hiking trail. Climb over rocks instead of using the Stairmaster. Natural movement is at the heart of MoveNat, an international fitness system that reclaims hunter-gatherer skills to achieve strength, flexibility, and power. Of course, being chased by a saber-toothed tiger will certainly get you moving faster now, won't it? I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Stephen J. Stack, the 170th president of the American Medical Association. Dr. Stack is a board-certified emergency physician, having served as medical director of multiple emergency departments in Kentucky and Tennessee. He has also served the American Medical Association's board of trustees in several capacities, including as its board chair and chair of the Compensation Committee. Dr. Stack has a special focus on health information technology, having served on several AMA advisory committees to the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. He earned his medical degree from Ohio State University. Dr. Stack, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
And, you know, the mission of the American Medical Association is to promote the art and science of medicine for the betterment of public health and also to advance the interest of physicians and their patients. And certainly one major activity of the American Medical Association is as a lobbying organization for the nation's physicians. And there's been so much change and transformation going on out of Washington. And can you tell our listeners what you see as the most pressing issue for physicians and patients alike as you take on the mantle of the presidency of the American Medical Association?
Well, I would say that the health system is in a remarkable period of flux and transformation. We undertook a journey a few years ago to create a new strategic vision for the work we do at the AMA. And in that, we have undertaken three major projects. And we find that physicians face a regulatory tsunami in which they feel challenged and unsupported all too often. And so the AMA is undertaking an enormous body of work to enhance and improve physician satisfaction and practice sustainability. And to that end, we've undertaken multiple research projects in partnership with the RAND Corporation and are trying to better understand those things that support physicians in the provision of high quality and affordable care for patients. And then we have two other major areas, taking on the most difficult of chronic health conditions in the United States, prediabetes and hypertension, of which there's over 70 million people plus the nearly 90 million people with prediabetes. And so those two conditions alone cost over $500 billion a year to the U.S. health system. And if we can make a dent in that, in this period of incredible flux in the healthcare system, it's essential that the new physicians of tomorrow have the knowledge and skills necessary to thrive and succeed in a way that helps them provide the best quality care for patients. And to this end, the AMA created a consortium of 11 medical schools and have funded $11 million over a five-year period for these 11 schools to create a learning consortium to radically reform medical education and to create the medical school of the future. Physicians with an enhanced skill set that enables them to be effective leaders and effective advocates and effective providers of health care for their patients.
Well, Dr. Stack, when I think about the regulatory tsunami, it strikes me that each of those three are significantly impacted by the way practices are organized. And I know that the AMA recently conducted a survey of the nation's medical providers and found that a majority of physicians still work in small practices. What does the data show you about the typical configuration of the work environments of the nation's physicians, and what shifts do you expect to see in the way practices are structured?
So we found that the number of physicians in small practices remained the majority at about 61%. On the other side of this, we found that the share of physicians who worked directly for a hospital or in practices that had at least some hospital ownership increased modestly from 29% in 2012 to 33% in 2014. So clearly there is a trend towards increasing physician employment by hospitals, but it is not the falling off the cliff experience. Mm-hmm. So just this past June, released for all physicians in the United States, a series of 16 modules called Steps Forward. And it's a free online series of proven solutions that have been developed by physicians for physicians, covering a number of things: how to make your office practice more efficient, how to select, and then how to implement an electronic health record. People submit ideas via that website for solutions to challenging clinical problems. And we hope to fund and grant five or more people who come up with novel solutions to help us create some new modules to further help physicians. All of this takes place in the context of us continuing our advocacy, the incredible crush and burden of regulatory difficulties with ICD-10 implementation, the electronic health record meaningful use. You referenced at the beginning my participation and moderation of a panel to try to give voice from the grassroots to physician concerns about the current state of electronic health records in the federal government's meaningful use program.
And Dr. Stack, certainly there must be a lot of consternation about the way practices are compensated. And we see the rise of accountable care organizations and patient-centered medical homes. And can you tell our listeners how these emerging approaches are impacting the physician practices?
In our study, we found three key things. Physicians have actually seen some positive effects from the models. Doctors have said that they actually like the concept. When the model is fair and reasonable, they like being paid to help keep patients healthy. And they also found, though, that though they want to embrace these new payment models, they require an infrastructure and they require adequate resources. That's both financial and in human resources in order to achieve these goals. But that the current programs frequently do not provide those resources. So, and then the final thing I would say is that one physician summed it all up, that it's like there's so much lack of coordination across these that he said that it was like 50 people all shouting their priorities to you at the same time. So we need to streamline and harmonize quality metrics. We need to make sure that there is timely, accurate, and actionable data. And we need to make sure that these new payment and delivery models provide physicians and their practices the resources, like I said, both financial and human, in order to make them successful.
Well, Dr. Stack, now you conducted a recent town hall meeting called Cutting the Red Tape, where you certainly heard a number of concerns from providers about this issue. I understand the AMA has asked HHS, Health and Human Services, to push back on meaningful use stage 3. Share this with our listeners. What does this mean in short?
The government requirements related to EHR technology have interfered with face-to-face discussions with patients. They've created new costs that divert resources away from patient care improvements. The much-anticipated benefits of being able to share important patient health information electronically among and between providers in different settings has gone utterly unfulfilled. In another landmark study, physicians found electronic health records to be the current most frustrating and profound obstacle to providing quality patient care. And it's resulted in a lot of physician dissatisfaction, emotional fatigue. Having said that, one of my other favorite quotes is referred to physicians as digital omnivores. We are some of the fastest and most widespread adopters of new and early technologies such as smartphones and tablet computers. So we have asked the administration to hold off on the final stage of the meaningful use program because the jump between stages 1 and 2 has already been so substantial. So many of those physicians at the town hall in Atlanta commented that they had adopted one person, I think it was 1984, they had first adopted an electronic health record. That is more than 20 years before the federal government created the meaningful use program. And yet these people are struggling to work within the current construct of meaningful use in the current world of EHRs. One of those people even wrote their own personal electronic health record himself, and he's now reverted back to it and is taking a 1% penalty from the government. His own software helped him to be far more efficient and effective for his patients. So there's always the risk of sounding overly negative. There is no doubt that we need to move forward with effective and well-done health IT. We have to take this massive one-fifth of the economy and organize it in a more effective way that enables us to better learn from it and to better share it when it's appropriate between physicians and other clinicians and our patients. And so one of the reasons we're doing town halls is to try to get the grassroots physician the opportunity to share just how constructively engaged they have been, the incredible amount of time, effort and money they have invested trying to make this succeed, and why it's so important for policymakers and others to hear their concerns.
We're speaking today with Dr. Stephen J. Stack, president of the American Medical Association. Dr. Stack is a board-certified emergency physician. So, you know, I do want to pull the thread a little more on this because you also said earlier that you were trying to think about the next generation of providers and have 11 medical schools working on that and wonder how much technology is going to loom in that sort of new training.
Right now, there's more than 80% of physicians in the United States using electronic health records. Kudos for that. So at this point now, we think that the federal government should focus on prioritizing all of its efforts to interoperability, to making these digital silos, which we have sadly created, actually interconnect and communicate with each other. We also think that technological innovation will be enhanced if the regulations from the federal government are reduced. So the vendors for electronic health records and the physicians and hospitals are now empowered to work together to make those systems serve them in the way they need to. We want to make sure that patients are informed. We don't think that some of the rigidly mandated ways that we've been told we must structure those data through patient portals and other things are either what some of our patients are asking for or are being produced by vendors in a way that is usable and easy for patients and physicians. So we really want to make those things better. And we think allowing natural innovation to occur would be a far better mechanism for that. In our medical education work, we do have some schools who are working very specifically to use real patient data to run simulated healthcare environments where the students manage and treat virtual patients, if you will, using real data and learn how to most effectively make use of electronic health record technology. Health IT is far bigger than just electronic health records. Mm-hmm. And we often confuse or conflate the two. So with wearables like Fitbits and with smartphones and other devices that collect patient-generated data, there is an enormous tidal wave of change ahead where we will have this incredible influx of data, and we're going to have to find ways to find among that massive amount of data what helps patients and physicians work together to provide better care. But we have to be very careful. Just within the last 2 weeks, there was a breach affecting maybe 4.5 million patients whose health records were compromised. The Office of Personnel Management for the federal government had, 22 million people whose data was compromised? And so for all of us who have to have 15 passwords, the data is incredibly secure from those of us who need it, but apparently not secure from those who shouldn't have access to it. So we've got to find a rational way to make that safer.
I'm going to shift just a little bit to say that I think the AMA is not shy about butting heads with policymakers on issues that are of importance to your members and to the organization. And a recent issue was the ongoing SGR formula, the sustainable growth issue, which was finally resolved after more than a decade. So congratulations for that. And another such issue is the switch to the ICD-10 codes for medical billing, which you've been actively lobbying against for quite some time, successfully winning a delay last year for the planned start date. But this year, I understand the AMA has come to an agreement with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, choosing to recommend compliance with this year's October 1 start date. Tell us a little bit about the AMA's reason, both for the pushback, also the nature of the compromise that you were able to achieve.
I've had the real privilege to work with physicians, other participants in the healthcare system, and policymakers. They're committed civil servants trying to do the best they can. None of this is ever personal. This is all about the issues and differences of opinion and trying to get most effectively to an outcome I think most of us share.
Mm-hmm.
So ICD-10 is a good example of this. The AMA has raised concerns that there is an inordinate amount of detail and complexity. The code set explodes by over 400%. And there are certain elements of the detail in there that make it a particularly challenging paradigm shift for how we're going to have to document certain things. The collaboration we've had with CMS, which I think is a wonderful example of how policymakers and the profession can work together, acknowledges that there's this complexity. And for a period of time, for the first year of the implementation, the physicians will still be required to use the new code set and to code in the right family of codes. But that enhanced specificity, where most people do acknowledge there's a lot of complexity and uncertainty, will not in and of itself be a reason to deny a claim. So if you see a physician, you have chest pain, we still have to document you have chest pain. We have to code that correctly that you have chest pain. But we may not have to put that you have acute chest pain secondary to chronic hypertension, secondary to water skiing after fell off a ladder. So that's the obscene kind of examples that people come up linking together bizarre circumstance. And so over the first 12 months of this, we'll continue to partner and work with CMS and with the private payer community to try to find what is a good and new reasonable steady state, but not drown out physician practices with economic distress because of denied claims, which would make it difficult for them to keep their doors open and care for patients. And so I think it's a wonderful partnership we've had, and we hope and will strive mightily to try to make that transition this October 1st as smooth as possible for everybody involved.
We've been speaking with Dr. Stephen J. Stack, president of the American Medical Association. You can follow their work by going to AMA-ASSN.org, or you can follow him on Twitter at Stephen Stack, MD. Dr. Stack, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you. It's been a great privilege and pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
On the subject of medicinal marijuana, Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina said that, quote, we don't understand how it interacts with other drugs, but there is information about marijuana's interactions with other medications. Prescribing information for approved versions of medicinal marijuana does include drug interaction details. However, there is less information available on medicinal marijuana compared with other medications because its legal status makes it more difficult to study in clinical trials. The prescribing information for one pill form of medicinal marijuana includes warnings about potential interactions, such as depressive effects when used with any central nervous system depressant. Another pill form warns that it should be used with caution by those also using sedatives, hypnotics, or psychoactive drugs. Studies have looked at the effect of medicinal marijuana specifically on patients undergoing cancer treatment. That was the context of Fiorina's remarks. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2009. One study published in 2007 found that an herbal tea of medicinal marijuana doesn't significantly influence how certain cancer drugs function. Another study from 2011 found that medicinal marijuana combined with a drug used to treat brain tumors produced a strong anti-tumor effect. And for HIV/AIDS patients, a 2003 study found no adverse effects on patients from medicinal marijuana. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Depression is extremely common among adolescents in this country, but it's often hard to differentiate between typically teen angst and a clinical condition that requires more immediate intervention. Suicide is the third leading cause of death among 10 to 24-year-olds, a population that almost ubiquitously uses texting as a form of communication. Nancy Lublin is founder and CEO of Crisis Text Line, an instant texting service designed to encourage teens in crisis to reach out for help, which they receive instantly. All they have to do is text the numbers 741-741.
So if you're someone who's in pain, you text us, and then the counselor on the other side is not working from a phone. They're on a screen that almost looks kind of like Facebook or Gmail. When messages come in with certain keywords in them, they automatically get tagged as high risk. So we don't take them chronologically. If you're at risk for suicide, you're automatically bumped up in the queue and you're like a code red. You get flagged in our system. And the supervisor would determine whether or not this person with the imminent harm.
Since she founded Crisis Text, the word has spread like wildfire. They receive an average of 15,000 texts per day from kids experiencing everything from typical teen dilemmas, such as a fight with a boyfriend, to kids contemplating suicide Those in most danger are encouraged to take action through a series of channels. Crisis text line, an instant, age-appropriate intervention, available free of charge and 24/7 to give kids in crisis a lifeline and lead them to help they need. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.